with songs and sketches and jokes old and new. With us advance, the U and Bill Blue. So meet the gang, cause the boys are here. The boys to entertain you.
My name is Stuart McGugan, and I played Gunner Atlas McIntosh, one of the hairy ass squaddies in the Basher. Well, that's all a bit of a mystery. I was in repertory theatre in Leeds at the time. I got a call through my agent that Messrs. Croft and Perry would like to see me. The only time I could see them was on a Monday morning because I was doing 8 shows a week in Leeds. So I went down and met them at what was commonly known as the Acton Hilton, which was a 7-story rehearsal room at North Acton, run by the BBC, with a restaurant on the top, administration on the ground floor, and all the other floors were rehearsal rooms. So everything was rehearsed there. And I was interviewed, or I chatted to, it didn't feel like an interview, I chatted to David and Jimmy. They were in there rehearsing an episode of Dad's Army. And we just talked about things generally, and I made my way back up to Leeds for the performance that evening. But my main memory of the day, I'm sorry, it wasn't David or Jimmy, halfway through the meeting, John Laurie, Private Fraser from Dad's Army, came over and was introduced to me as a fellow Scot. And John loomed over me and he said, "Hello, they're all scared of me, you know." With his eyes going like Catherine wheels. And my main memory of that meeting was going back up to Leeds thinking, I met John Laurie today. Then there was a long pause, and I was booked for the pilot, which was, again, another happy coincidence. I had 10 days off from Leeds Playhouse while the kids' program, the kids' play, went in at Christmas. And right in the middle of that 10 days, the BBC decided to record the pilot for It Ain't Half Hot Mum, so I could make it and do it. There was an earlier connection which might have had something to do with it. Ian Lavender and I both spent our first seasons at the same theatre. He came from Bristol Old Vic, I came down from Glasgow, and we were in Canterbury at the Marlow Theatre there. Both newcomers, both our first season. If I remember correctly, Ian went off at the end of that season to start playing Private Pike, because his agent was Anne Croft, married to David Croft, and that's that connection. There might have been an oblique connection through Ian and Anne to David with me. I don't know. But it certainly worked out well in my favour, because we did the pilot and then we had to hang about for about 6 months while the BBC made up its mind, and off we went on the first series. That was a bit of a sore point with us, because round about the same time, there was a show called Tenko on, which was about the Second World War, the Japanese treatment of women captured in, I think, Singapore. And the ladies doing Tenko got sunbeds and all kinds of jollies in order to brown themselves up nicely for the show. We were a comedy department, so we didn't have that luxury. What happened was we got shipped off. If it was desert, we got shipped off to Norfolk. And if it was jungle, it was usually down about Farnham somewhere, and they just bunged some jungle dingle in front of the camera. But we were covered in brown makeup every morning, 6:30, I'd be in makeup. And I was also stupid enough to insist on having tattoos, which had to be done every morning, half asleep. We then went out to the sand pit in Norfolk. And it was bloody cold, because however warm England is at the end of August, beginning of September, there is a definite nip in the air, and we were getting the wind straight off the North Sea over this bunch of shivering actors. And to make matters worse, just before each take, makeup would come along and throw glycerin on us to make it look like we were perspiring horribly, when that lowered the temperature even more. So it was pretty rough. We all did it, though, because we were all troopers and we were all quite excited about doing this show. Yes, the routine was we would do all the exterior shots, be they desert or jungle. We'd do them at the start of the series, right at the very beginning, all 6, 7 or 8 episodes, however many it was. All the exterior shots were done out of sync on the location. Then we had 10 days off, I guess, and we went into studio then, up to the Acton Fun Factory of a Monday morning and rehearsed through to Thursday when the technical rehearsal was held. And then on Friday, usually Friday, we were in studio at the BBC in Wood Lane to record all the interior stuff. And then David took it all off and edited it together, glued it all up. Well, I've always referred to them as the hairy-assed squaddies. We, the guys in the actors in the Basha, the concert party itself, were a great bunch of guys. It was a very noisy setup. Anytime up in the Acton Hilton restaurant, all the noise would come from our table because we had Chris Mitchell, Ken McDonald, Dino Shafiq, Baba Bhatti, Don Estelle, Windsor Davis. We were a noisy crowd, but great fun to be with. Obviously great fun and very, I think naughty is the right word to describe what we got up to on location and in studio. Well, I seem to do a lot of my acting with Melvin, who played Gloria, because Melvin's character, Gloria, was the only true professional in the bunch, apart from George Layton, who in the early series was the director. The rest of us were completely, apart from Don Estelle, were completely without talent. This was the whole point of the concert party. We were in there to stop being sent up the jungle to be killed by the Japanese. And so our aim was simply survival. Don had the benefit of an exquisite tenor voice. So he at least was gifted, talented in that way. But the rest of us were just doing the best we could with the very little ability we had. Mike Kinsey, who played Nosher, folded paper as an act. I was supposed to be the strong man, and they helped me in this by usually standing me in the middle of Don Estelle and Melvin, who looked quite titchy compared to me. I wasn't particularly big, but that helped. But we tended all, as a concert party, we were just a group of talentless guys blundering about the place trying to put a show on. They were inspired. There was some terrific casting went on in that show. Michael Knowles and Donald Hewlett, Sir Don, to differentiate from Little Don. Sir Don and Michael were a terrific double act and beautifully written by Messrs. Croft and Perry because there was a class difference between them. The colonel was upper middle class and the captain was very, the silly ass, was very definitely just middle class. And that there was a lot of class consciousness in the show as well. We all had our different geographical areas to take care of as performers. I had Scotland, Windsor had Wales, we had Nobby was from Manchester, Mike was from Birmingham. So every area of the country was catered for by one of the cast members. But then the class thing was taken care of by Messrs. Sir Don and Michael Knowles, who worked beautifully together. I think they may have worked before then. They certainly did subsequently in Eurangmalord. But it was a lot of these castings were down to David and Jimmy, and they were pretty inspired. Well, I was not a favorite one as such, but I was reminded of an episode the other day in which a baby elephant appeared. It came from the local circus. And it turned up on the set. Why do I remember this? The elephant was called Vicky. And the only way we could get it out of the set, according to the plot, was Don had to serenade it out of the camp. Which, you know, you couldn't write stuff like that. You couldn't make stuff up like that. It was brilliantly done. The elephant was a terrific performer, and Don sang it out of the camp. But talking about brilliant performers, no particular episode stands out, but there were bits of different episodes. Michael Bates, who played Randy Ram, the bearer for the first, I think, half dozen series, and sadly died during the series. He was the most inventive comedy actor I think I've ever worked with. If I would urge you, your listeners and viewers, if they do have the DVDs, get the early ones and watch Michael Bates at work. It's a fabulous performance as the Indian bearer. And he did one thing in one episode. He wanted to be more British than the British, the bearer. And Michael walked his bicycle round the back of the parade ground, put it up against the Sergeant Major's basher, and then bent down and took a pair of cycle clips off his bare ankles. And if you saw it, it was funny. It didn't wave it about saying, look, bit of funny business with cycle clips here. They were on his bare ankles and holding nothing up, but they were very British, these cycle clips. And he put them in his little pouch and wandered off. Tiny piece of beautiful comedy. Didn't really take, I mean, as long as it took a bunch of people to get the same tune and the same steps. We had a choreographer, we had an accompanist, and we had Jimmy, who was very keen to get this precisely right. Jimmy had personal experience of concert parties during the Second World War, so he knew precisely what he was talking about. David had been in Burma in the army in the Second World War, so we were talking to guys who'd experienced all this. And it was our job as this company. It was quite early on in the show, obviously. We had to get together, record the opening number. We did it in a studio, I think, just off the Gold Hawk Road in Shepherd's Bush. And I think it took a couple of days, given the retake necessary, as one after another we screwed it up. But they eventually did get one complete take. Well, it was a pretty bad show for corpsing, for laughing out of turn. Don Estelle, for example, now bless him, he was about 5 foot tall, almost completely spherical. He was described as a singing coconut in one episode by the Sergeant Major, blessed with this glorious tenor voice. But Don found it very difficult to resist laughing when he shouldn't really have been, when especially dealing with Windsor. Windsor, if you remember, would come down from his height slowly down into the same head size as Don for the two shot. And you're very vulnerable when you're in a shot like that. And there is one part of, there is an episode where Don had to play the trumpet at the raising or the lowering of the flag ceremony. And he just loses it entirely at the end. You just watch this wee guy nearly wetting himself because he's trying not to laugh. And it was full of, well, we try to make each other laugh all the time when we shouldn't have done. The captain and the colonel had a terrible time with us squaddies because we would be lined up on one side of the studio and they would be opposite us giving us instructions. And we knew from the light on the camera that they were shooting it over our shoulders, so nobody saw us. And the captain and the colonel were in full shot. So that, well, you can imagine five or six of us squaddies all gurning away at the captain and the colonel trying to put them off. And we did occasionally get Sir Don corpsing in the middle and having to do a retake, which is always a bit of a joy. But yeah, yes, there was a lot of retakes done because people were laughing in the wrong place. Oh, I vaguely remember we all hoiked off to Abbey Road when we recorded half a dozen numbers there. But the real success of that, of course, was Windsor and Don recorded a number, an old Ink Spots number called Whispering Grass. And that was a summertime hit for about 2 months. It was top of the pops. And there would be little Don with his pith helmet, Windsor in his uniform, on top of the pops, can you believe it? And they were there for ages. It was a huge success. Mind you, I do remember Don being absolutely appalled later on at just how much money the record company took out of the deal. And as a result of that, he tended after that to promote his own records himself. And he was spotted like a rare bird in various shops up and down the country well after the show had finished, with the pith helmet and the shorts on, singing into a microphone and selling his records. And he was getting 100% of the profits this time, not like before. I can quite understand why a white man blacking up or browning up as an Indian would be regarded as politically incorrect by some. At the same time, again, I would urge you to watch Michael Bates' performance. It was always very funny. He was always very dignified. And the bearer and the soldiers always won. The sergeant never won. In his ambition to get us up country to be killed by the Japanese, to make proper soldiers of us, he never won. Michael Bates' performance was superb. He knew what he was doing because he was, I believe, born in India. His father was in the Indian Army, I believe. He spoke fluent Urdu. He spoke better Urdu than the Charwala and the Punkawala. And I have yet to hear an Indian person or a person of Indian origin complain about Michael's performance. It tends to become from, well, when we made that show, comedy was run by people who'd done variety, who'd been in theater in variety, had gone through the war, and they were the people in charge of comedy. Then, and one could argue, sadly, comedy or situation comedy was taken over by people who'd been to university and was commensurately less funny and less broad and less kind. Subsequently, there have been smart-ass comedians on television with cruel situation comedies. Harsh, harsh stuff. Our humour was always gentle. It might not have been racially perfect. Tastes change, atmospheres change, but it was always warm and well-intentioned humour. And I can understand the BBC is a terrible monolithic organisation, scared of everything that moves. And I can understand why they just wouldn't want the flack of showing Michael's performances now. But again, all I can do and to combat that is to urge anyone who's listening to watch Michael Bates' performance. He is a supreme comedy actor, height of his powers, playing an amazing character. And it ran all the way through. While I was doing It Ain't Half Hot Mum in the early years, I did a couple, I think, of Dad's Armies. Turned up, did Scottish Squaddy and Dad's Armies. Then I did It Ain't Half Hot Mum. And then David and Jimmy went on to do You Rang My Lord. And there, they cast me in that as the Balshy shop steward of his lordship's rubber factory. And I think it was typical. Anytime David Croft wanted a Balshy jock, I'd get a call to pop in and do it for him. And I did it with the greatest of pleasure. Sadly, there's only two or three of us surviving from that show. And we went through a period of, and David Croft noticed this in his journals, in his autobiography, almost every member of the cast of It Ain't Half Hot Mum, during the run of It Ain't Half Hot Mum, got divorced. And no one's accepting responsibility for it. It wasn't the show's fault, but it did seem at one time that no one ended up the series with the same wife they started with. I don't know if anyone's taken responsibility for that. But no, we did 56, I think, episodes spread over 9 years. The show lasted longer than the war did. And oddly enough, I've been a pacifist since I can remember when, but the army has been very good to me as far as my career is concerned. It's been a lot of fun to do. And that show in particular, because of its longevity, because of the 8 years of it, is very fondly remembered by, I mean, just as a postscript, I have just moved house to about 5 miles from the sand pit we filmed in at Lazy Eight in Norfolk. And the people around here, I was talking to my new butcher in a little town called Gayton nearby here. He remembers as a kid, as a teenager, the excitement when the film unit turned up to the sand pit. And here I am after wandering about the world for a career in the business. I'm back in Norfolk and it's on my schedule to visit the sand pit and pay it my respects, because it was cold, but it was funny. My great pleasure, Andrew. All the very best to you and to your listeners and viewers.
Three, two, three, oh, why, yes, boys, to entertain you.